There we go. Okay, I think we're all set to go.
Well, speaking about Princess Anne.
Whoops.
we were having the celebration of the 150th anniversary of the formation of our regiment.
Right.
And she is our colonel in chief.
Ah.
So we invited her to come over and to be present at the celebration. We knew she wouldn't come. And she jumped at it. She loves to be around soldiers.
Really?
So anyway, she came and we had all the band playing and the marching and speeches and everything. And when it was all over, everybody, the people in the VIP tent where I was, adjourned to the hospitality tent. I had all my hardware on. And so I was standing around having a drink, and this little ADC came dancing over a real fruit, dancing over, and he said, "Her Highness would like to speak with you." I said, "Fine, send her over." He just about dropped it.
I bet.
In his tracks. So finally, he realized he was talking to a joker.
Yes.
So anyway, we went over, and I knew she was going to say one or two things, because I've walked behind these people reviewing troops often enough. They usually say, "How long have you been with the regiment?" or "Where are you from?" Those are questions that you can get a quick answer for.
Right, that's true.
The guy doesn't have to stop and think, "Oh, no, let me see. The quick," and then they move on, you see. So anyway, she said to me, "Where are you from?" Well, I said, "I'm from a little place called Rossay, outside St. John. And it's a very small place. In fact, it is so small, we don't have a town drunk. We have to take turns." Well, she put a hand up to her forehead, and her knees started to collapse. And finally, she gasped out, and she said, "And so you do your part." I said, "Yes, I do." I thought, "Now you will take that back to England with you. You'll be dining out on that one all next winter."
Definitely. For the record, I'm talking with Tim Ellis. It's Jude Carson talking with Tim Ellis.
Look, you'll have to speak up a little bit. Okay. Oh, wait a minute. I took my hearing aid.
Oh, okay.
What did I do with that? I took my hearing aid.
I can sit closer too, Tim, if you want. Would it help?
I just want...
Didn't get knocked
out.
No?
Hmm.
Closer. No,
but I took my hearing aid.
And now you got to find it.
So I could talk on the phone.
Might be right out there. Okay.
I'll be right back. Yeah, when I called my sister, I get feedback.
Oh, okay.
If I try and talk on the phone. Okay, well, let's go.
Okay, I'll sit over here. How about this?
Let's go.
There we go.
Yeah.
No, I was just saying for the tape machine, identifying who you are. And we're talking, it's November 8th, 2009. Because this is for the record, you know, we want to keep them. Well, let's just go where we're on the military. Give me a little bit of your background in the military.
Well, I always wanted to be a soldier. And when I went to Rossay Collegiate, I was there 6 years. We wore the same uniform every day. And we drilled just like soldiers twice a week. We carried a rifle.
Now, when would this be? What years would that be?
From 1927 to 1933.
Okay.
And... we had a connection with the military that they used to run a class for Canadian Officers Training Corps. Normally, this is only done through university.
Okay.
But anyway, there were two sergeant major instructors. That was a special rank they had. They used to come out. These are World War I veterans.
Okay.
And they would give us talks and teach us how to read maps and one thing to another. Mm-hmm. And after I graduated from RCS, I joined the St. John Fusiliers as a second lieutenant. And in those days, you didn't get paid. You had to buy your own uniform and everything. And meantime, I learned to fly. And my license was issued by the Department of National Defense. There was no Department of Transport then.
So, now, wait a minute. You learned to fly just because you wanted to learn?
I always wanted to learn to fly.
Okay.
But at the same time, I liked the idea of being a soldier.
Okay.
I liked the marching around and the bands and all the good stuff I found out later. I didn't know that I was going to have to be sent out to kill somebody later on. But
so you learned to fly.
I learned to fly, and I wasn't very attentive at these evening gatherings where you marched around a drill hall and so on. So I had gone to work. By the way, I graduated from RCS on a Friday. I went to work with the Bank of Nova Scotia on Monday. So there was a great big important, self-important guy that had an insurance business, and he was a captain in the MD Rangers, and he was one of our customers. And one day he said, "Now, Mr. Ellis, you're a Kings County boy. You should be in my company out in Rossay, MD Rangers." So I said, "Well, how do I do that?" Well, he said, "I'll just arrange your transfer." So I became a second lieutenant in the Brunswick Rangers. So when the war came along, I had been flying for 5 years, and I had my license, and I told the man I had been flying for 5 years and never bent one. I bent one once, but I didn't tell him about that. And, but he didn't like the look of my medical. When I was about 8 years old, I was involved in a shooting accident, and I got the side of a shotgun pattern as it went by after the woodcock, and I got one pellet up in my head and one just under my eye, two in my nose and two through my ear. I just got the side of the pattern, luckily, or I'd have been dead.
Yes.
So anyway, I didn't have any vision in my right eye. Of course, I found that right away and said, "Look, we can't use you." Mm-hmm. And I noticed he didn't have any wings on his tunic. He was flying a desk. I was used to flying airplanes. So, no, he said, "We couldn't use you." Well, I said, "I'm flying now. I've been flying for a long time." "Well, sorry, no." So I said, "Okay, I'll go back to the NB Rangers." And so I went back to the Rangers, and they said, "Oh, God, Tim, we've filled up all our establishment, all our vacancies, and there's no open door for you." Well, he said, "Just a minute. We have one fella off our strength on detached duty, and I could skid you in his place to complete our establishment, but if he comes back, it's like musical chairs. You're going to have to go somewhere else." I said, "Well, I'll chance it." So they gave me a quick refresher course at Camp Sussex that lasted about 10 days. I didn't learn anything new. I just rehashed a lot of old stuff I'd learned before. And they sent me up to Fredericton to be an officer instructor at the training center, number 90 training center. You see, Mackenzie King wouldn't put in conscription, but what he did do, he had national registration. Mm-hmm. He got everybody to register, and single men between, I think it was 18 and 25, were called up in batches to take 30 days military training.
Okay.
And then they went back to working in the woods or crawling under cars or whatever mm-hmm. they did.
Mm-hmm.
Or they could join up.
Okay.
Hopefully they would join up. The thing was, the 1st Division had gone over to England, and everybody who was out of a job had joined the Army.
Right.
So there was a vacancy in working people, hands-on people,
right.
The lower echelon. So there wasn't much attraction for them to sign up and be a soldier at $1.20 a day.
Wow.
When they could get X dollars an hour a
right.
day hammering nails
right.
in a new army hut. That's
yeah, it's okay. No, I moved. That's good. No, it's right over here.
This one.
I love the sun, but I'd rather look at you right now.
Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
So anyway, I went up there and they put me, I was a second lieutenant, which is the very lowest officer. And I was second in command of a company of 250 of these people that we used to bring in by train from all over the province to give them 30 days training. And my officer was a guy called George F.G. Stanley, G.F.G. Stanley, who later became Lieutenant Governor of the province.
Okay.
And George was a Rhodes Scholar, and he had this phony English accent
uses.
But he spent most of his time around the mess with a clipboard, and planning and studying and so on. I was the guy that was out in the rain and sleet teaching the guys how to dig.
And how old were you?
Fire stations, fire positions. Well, I was then... 1941, I was 25.
Oh, okay.
I was just at the right age because I was older than these 18-year-old
right.
teenagers.
Right, yeah.
I wasn't of an age where I'd been in the Army drinking beer and going to
That's
summer
right.
camps for 10 years and
yeah.
thought I knew everything. And in good physical shape and so on. So anyway, we started turning these guys out, and I never afterwards saw as efficient an operation as number 90 Basic Training mm-hmm. Center. So one day, Colonel Harold Gamblin, who was Colonel of the 8th Hussars, came on a visit. And he was looking for officers to fill up the quota in his regiment.
Mm-hmm.
And he was looking for 4 lieutenants. So 4 of us jumped ship,
mm-hmm.
and I left the NV Rangers and became an 8th Hussar. So at that time they were in Sussex, and I was only with them a few days when they were loaded on trains and went to Camp Borden to train.
Okay.
It was an armored regiment,
mm-hmm.
supposedly. We didn't have any tanks, but we had the name of an armored regiment. We had motorcycles and station wagons and trucks and that sort of thing. So that was in April, in February of, no, yeah, that was about April of 41. And we trained all summer, and then in the fall we went over to England. And I was in England for 2 years. By the way, I wrote a little book about how I won the war.
Oh, did you?
In fact, I will give you that to keep, because I just had 25 new ones printed
out. Oh, you did? Well, thank you very much. Oh, great.
And you'll see a Carson in there, fellow named Earl Carson from up in Havelock.
Okay.
That's where all the Carsons came from up there.
Ah.
Anyway.
Great, thank you.
We went over to, and we were there 2 years. And, it was this course and that course and another course and another course. And I was I was made a driving and maintenance instructor on American tanks. I was on a course that lasted about 2 months. And one time down in, Bovington, which is the Armored Corps center for all the British Army, I was driving this big American tank, and the sergeant instructor was up in the turret. And he said, "Captain Ellis, you see a curve up in the road up ahead of you?" I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "That's where Lawrence of Arabia got crowded off the road and killed in his motorcycle."
Really?
Did you ever hear of Lawrence in Arabia?
Oh, definitely, yes.
Well, he was an embarrassment to the British.
Yeah.
Because he'd promised the Arabs all these things mm-hmm. if they'd come with him. And he even dressed, he was a,
yes.
I think he was a homo, but he was a ham actor.
Yeah.
He used to wear the burnous with the rope around the top and a dagger and all this stuff. Knew how to ride a camel. Mm-hmm. In fact, he did ride a camel with this crew across the desert. But anyway, he was an embarrassment to the mm-hmm. British. Mm-hmm. And he sort of did a disappearing act for a while, and he resurfaced as Aircraftsman Shaw and joined the RAF. And I'm sure I know what happened. MI6 had the band down.
You think, yeah. Mm-hmm.
He used to take an evening run on his motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And a car crowded him off the road.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And he was killed. The car never stopped. And there wasn't much of an investigation.
Yeah.
And I know the government just killed that guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, one day we're down in Brighton, and we were on South Coast defense duty in case there was an invasion. By that time, the danger of invasion was over.
Mm-hmm.
But we used to keep our tanks in Hove Park. Brighton and Hove are two towns.
I know,
together.
I used to live in Eastbourne and go shopping in Brighton.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, one day the colonel called us together, and no, I'm not going to tell you this story about Brighton. I don't want to get off on the wrong foot here. Anyway, called us all together. And he said, "Now, this is going to be a special event. You are never told where the next move is going to be because we don't want a leak in security. But for this time, for once, we're going to tell you, you're all sworn to secrecy. But I'm going to tell you where we're going. We're going to Ireland, and we're going to train there and get all new equipment. And where we go from there hasn't been decided yet."
Okay.
So we got on the train, we went to Liverpool, and got off the train and got onto an ocean liner and chugged off into the ocean. And we were on the ocean 11 days. Well, Ireland's pretty close to Liverpool. So finally we came into port, and when two of these Kings County boys were leaning on the rail, and they were looking at these men in long nightshirts and black faces and curly hair, and women looking over their veils, and one of them said, "Well, they ain't Irish." We were in Algiers,
oh my
North
gosh.
Africa.
Oh my gosh.
This is the way, you know, I used to hear, use the expression, the British con, and nobody can con people like the British. In fact, I was in a couple of cons, and I didn't even know it until afterward.
Yeah. So you were in Africa for how long?
Well, we weren't there long. We were there a few weeks.
Oh, okay.
See, they want to send us by ship from Algiers over to Naples, but Naples was still occupied by the Germans.
Oh, right.
They were still fighting for it.
Yeah.
So what they were doing were just stalling off, waiting for the Americans and the Brits to capture Naples and free the port so we could get in.
Okay.
So eventually they put the run on the Germans out of Naples. Mm-hmm. Those bastards, those Germans. Before they left Naples, they sent their engineers in and they connected all the fresh water into Naples with the sewers.
Oh.
They contaminated every bathtub and kitchen tap and top in the city. Oh, look, these guys were the pits when it came to dirty tricks. They knew them all. So anyway, we arrived in Naples and we were just there overnight and they loaded us on trucks and took us down to a place called Matera. You know what the Italian boot looks like?
I was just there.
Well, Matera would be the ankle.
Right.
And we went down there. My God, I never saw such godforsaken country.
Yeah.
You know, here, we look out over the country and it's either forest or rolling fields. At Matera, it's rolling rocks.
Rock.
Just bedrock.
Yeah.
And what people are doing there...
Exactly.
I don't know what they live on.
No, exactly.
There's no water to catch fish in.
Yeah.
You couldn't grow anything. I think they just live there and kidnap people and steal and live by their wits.
Yeah.
Anyway, we spent the Christmas of 1943 there. And... we're living outdoors now. You've heard the expression sunny Italy. Well, that's not all year.
Yeah, no.
And we lived outdoors that first winter in the snow and sleet, and nobody caught cold.
Really?
Or got the flu or pneumonia.
Yeah, isn't that so?
The next winter, everybody was coming down with jaundice and colds and you name it, because we had gotten into buildings and we'd been coughing on each other, you see.
Isn't that something, yeah.
And so, anyway, we, I don't want to bear down on it too much. When you read my little book,
that's great.
You'll find out more about it.
But
we're in Italy 2 winters and a summer. And I never thought I was going to get out of the country alive because it was so easy to get killed.
Really?
And I used to tell my guys, I said, look, for God's sake, don't make it any easier for them.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're going somewhere, don't stroll. Walk along smartly.
Yeah.
So the sniper hasn't got time to line the sights up on
exactly,
you.
Exactly. Yeah.
And don't stand in a group. Don't two or three... get together and start bombing a cigarette from one another or talking about the girl you almost dated on your last leave and all this, because they're looking at you.
Yeah.
You'd look over the country and you just think you had got out of the car out in Sussex somewhere.
Really?
Looking at the fields and the olive groves and the grapevines and the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
There were thousands and thousands of Germans right in the middle of that in underground, and they were looking at you all the time. You couldn't see them, but they could see you.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't waste a great big shell that big on some guy trotting along with an Enfield rifle.
Yeah.
But if they could catch 15 or 20 around a cook truck getting a meal, then they'd give the word from the big gun 8 miles back and this thing would come over and blammo! That'd be it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Of all the people, all the Canadians who went to Italy, and a lot of them weren't there to fight. They were working in the YMCA, they were truck drivers, they were doctors, they were dentists, they were Padres people, they were postal workers, they were traffic policemen and whatnot. 1 in 4 was a casualty.
Really?
1 in 4.
And these were the non-military.
And even considering some of them were never shot at, yeah, and never would be, but the ones who were just getting just like a lead pencil. Just you had to keep sharpening it all the time. You're wearing it down, wearing it down. And this bastard McKenzie King, he wouldn't send he wouldn't put in conscription. And everybody who had volunteered to go overseas was overseas.
Right, yeah.
There was no follow-up.
Right.
No reinforcement stream. Well, there was some. They all had little dribble. And the poor infantry, you know, they'd go into a fight with a company with 80 in it, and they'd come out with 62. And the next night, they'd have to put in another attack, and they'd come out with 55 and so on. And then they'd pull them out for a rest and maybe add another 5 or 6 reinforcements. But eventually, now our tanks, I supported the Cape Breton Highlanders squadron. There are 20 tanks in a squadron, 100 men, 5 men to a tank. And we'd be about 200 yards back from the infantry. Mm-hmm. See, wherever the tanks were, that's where the Germans would drop the shells in.
Yes.
Because they figured, well, that's where the action's got to be. So that left the infantry out front dug in. Mm-hmm. And they were pretty well safe there. We took the hits. Mm-hmm. And we were there when the Germans attacked and drove the Canadian, the infantry back, we were there to beat the Germans off. We were counterattack people. And we worked directly with the Cape Breton Highlanders. And it was just like a soccer team or a basketball team. We'd be there on the ground with the engines idling, and the Highlander would come running back, crouched over, and he'd say, you see the farmhouse? Yeah. You see the pig pen? Yeah. You see the tree between the pig pen and the barn? Yeah. Well, there's a machine gun right under the tree. So we'd roll up one tank, fire about 4 rounds out of the big gun, and then you'd see the Highlander. He'd go like that, and his boys would jump up out of the grass, and they'd run ahead.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then they'd get held up a little further on, and we'd repeat the thing. So anyway, it got so bad that, well, in my book, I mentioned it there one time. We were married up, as they called it, with the Cape Bretoners, and just sitting behind them. And in the middle of the night, I got this call over the wireless to pull up stakes and move along the canal bank. There, everywhere in Italy, you think of mountains, but there are an awful lot of runoffs down the mountain, and they would direct the flow of water just like a great big drain pipe down toward the ocean. And they were really canals, and they'd have big dikes on each side with a roadway on top of each one. And that's where you had to go. And the engineers would build a daily bridge from one to the other and lose men doing it. They were terribly brave. So I lost a thread there.
Well, how long were you there? Like you were there for the duration of the war?
No. No, we were there for 2 winters.
Okay.
We went there in December, and we were there all that winter, all the next summer, and the next winter until February. Mm-hmm. And this is, I gotta tell you this, B Squadron, my squadron, and the Cape Breton Highlanders were at the very point of the whole 8th Army. There was nobody any further north than we were.
Really?
And we were right around an area called San Alberto, Below Venice, there's a big valley called the Valley of Comacchio.
Okay.
And San Alberto is on the shore of Lake Comacchio.
Okay.
So we had kind of stopped there till they figured where we were going to go next. Mm-hmm. And the word came over that it was possible to have 48-hour skiing for anybody who wanted to ski. Well, I've been skiing all my life. They said, we got everything for you. So a lieutenant called Jerry Worrell and I went skiing. Now, there's an area just about 10 miles in from the coast called San Marino.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a republic. It's just like Switzerland. It's not part of Italy at all.
Mm-hmm.
And we were promised a court-martial if anybody dropped so much as a rifle bullet across the boundary. And there it was, way up on the hilltop. And it looked down on Coriano Ridge. That's where we had one of our most awful fights.
Mm-hmm.
The British got bloody nose there. They got thrown to hell off it. Somebody else had a whack at it. They couldn't hang on. Canadians came along. They lost a lot of men, but they got on and stayed there. So anyway, we were up at San Alberto. So we got into something with wheels and drove up to San Marino and checked into this big hotel. I looked out the hotel window and here are two great big ruts in the mud right beside the hotel. So I asked one of the staff, what made those? Oh, that's where the Grand Canoni was. That's where the Germans had their big gun. No wonder. They were looking right over my shoulder and dropping these great big dandies down whenever they felt like it. So anyway, I said, Jerry, we're just here for 2 days. How do you figure it? He said, we'll ski today and get drunk tomorrow. Well, I said, that suits me. So they had everything for us, white skis, white parkas, poles,
mm-hmm.
ski boots,
yeah.
everything. And we'd ski down as far as the cliff that went right over there, right on down. We'd do a telemark turn,
right.
And go over to the road, and this big 3-ton truck would take us back to San Marino. We'd ski down again and back out to the road.
Oh,
so anyway, after a day of that, we'd really end up skiing. So we had a few drinks and went to sleep in the hotel bedroom. And I woke up in the morning, and one of the batmen, a little fellow called Junior Johnson, was shaking me. He said, Major, he said, wake up, wake up, wake up. The whole regiment's moving out, and they sent me here to get you. I said, where are they going? He said, I don't know, but they said, all your tanks are loaded on flat cars down at Rimini, and they'll be leaving. So I said, well, you need to get out of here. So we got in this thing called an HUP, and I wish I could have bought an HUP. It was like a great big cab over engine. They were either Chevys or Fords.
Mm-hmm.
Just like a box.
Right.
And had a big open door at the back. And inside was a camp cot, a fold-down desk,
mm-hmm.
a kerosene heater, and shades for all the windows. And that was the greatest thing. You see, when you're planning an attack, you have what they call an O group, an orders group.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that need to know the orders come and you give it to them. Well, my God, if it's pouring rain or sleet and there's no shelter anywhere, and you've got to call these guys together in the middle of the night and give them their orders so they can mark up their maps. You just call up your HUP, get them inside, pull the curtains down, turn on the dome light. They get out their maps with the cellophane cover on them, and you give their order. They had their colored pencils, and they'd mark where we were and where we think the Germans are, and so on. And when they left there, they knew what they had to do, and everybody knew what they had to do. And if there was any extra little hint that I could give them, that was thrown into the mix, and that was the greatest invention. I've never even seen one in victory parades or anything.
Really?
But anyway, we eventually arrived at Rimini, which was where the highway and the railway go along the coast. My God, there were all my tanks. By the way, that is my own tank, even the name and the number and everything.
Really?
That's Beatty.
Yeah.
That was my home
Wow.
through the war. And anyway, we my God, the train started to go. And I said, "Junior, get this thing over to the tracks. I got to get on that train." There were two boxcars. They weren't together. They were spaced down the train. And the doors were open, and there was about this much straw in the bottom. So Junior bumped across. There were other tracks, and he got over. We got alongside, and I threw my bedroll in and opened the cab door. And one of the boys grabbed me by the arm and pulled me in. And Junior says, "Where do I go, sir?" I said, "I don't know. I don't know where I'm going." So, I mean, this is it. You know, they moved the whole 1st Canadian Corps. Now, a corps is two divisions. There are 15,000 men in one division.
Oh my gosh.
So they moved 30,000 men out of Italy, took them down to Livorno, Leghorn, took them by American tank landing ship over to Marseille and up into Belgium before the Germans knew that we had gone.
Really?
Can you believe it?
Wow.
Now, the reason they did it, anybody who was on leave, they just left them.
Oh, okay.
If there was a little kid that hung around your headquarters,
All right.
you'd take him for a drive 100 miles and put him off with some Italian family. And everybody had their berets. I think their berets, they just turned them inside out. But all their insignia was gone. There was every regiment, of course, had the name of the regiment and the divisional patch. Ours was maroon, 1st Division was red. And the regiment name of it, ANBH, 8th Brunswick Hussars. So anybody looking at you would know exactly who you were and where you're from and everything else. All that was obscured. Well, we went around a turn, and my God, I looked back at the other boxcar and the tanks with it. And on one tank, instead of the khaki camouflage tarpaulin, everything was pulled right down like a cocoon over the whole tank. You couldn't see anything except the tracks. And this great big tarpaulin was a maroon color, and it said Rimini Farina. Oh my God! Flower and feed. in the city of Rimini. That's where he had come from. And here the thing was so secret, and everybody had been told, anybody who goofs up,
yeah.
court-martial.
Yeah.
Court-martial. So I knew what had happened. One of the guys had taken the bank's tarpaulin and traded it for booze or lovemaking or something or other, and figured, well, they could get along without it. Suddenly, they got this order to move, and gee, no tarp. So they go downtown, and the first truck they come to belongs to the flour and feed company in Rimini. But it was dark, and of course they couldn't see the
writing. Yeah.
And instead of turning it inside out and turning all this Rimini Farina thing underneath, they left it on the outside. And here this bloody train, we had no connection with the locomotive at all.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
We had no wireless.
Right.
No line communication. There was just the engineer and the fireman. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, if he thought there were airplanes around, he'd pull into a cutting and he'd just stay there maybe half the night. And then he'd move on. I didn't dare get off the train to run up to the locomotive because I might never get back in the train again.
Right, yeah.
So finally, we approached Leghorn, and as we got near, the train started to slow down to get into the outskirts of Leghorn, and all these civilians started coming out of the woodwork and jumping up on the train. I had no way to stop them. Mm-hmm. And we get into Leghorn, and this British officer, captain, court official, he started to chew me out for bringing all these people into the secure area. I said, if it was secure, why didn't you make it secure? I said, there's no way I could keep these people off the train. Mm-hmm. Well, this is a secure area, and now you brought all these people inside it. So he started to me, and I said, listen, stand to attention. Salute me. And I'm not going to listen to any more of this. Now, you do what you have to do on your way.
Good for you.
So anyway, I was in a sweat because I was mentally preparing my court-martial defense, what I would say, how I would answer it, deal with the cross-examination. I couldn't sleep at night. So anyway, this morning of the same day that we arrived, they had six American LSTs, landing ship tanks, with the doors in the front. And we loaded the tanks on there. They closed the doors and chugged out into the Mediterranean. Obviously we're heading for the south of France. Well, about sundown, we were just going around, what's the island? Elba?
Mm-hmm.
And two funny-looking airplanes came up over the horizon. I remember they had three tail fins, very, very old, antique bombing planes. They just came up over the horizon and took a look at us and then disappeared. And I said to somebody, we're going to have trouble tonight. Those guys are spotters. Mm-hmm. They've seen where we're headed. And you know, we got into Marseille the next morning, no problem. Years later, I read that these planes, as soon as they got down, they organized a naval attack for that night.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent a force of German E-boats. These are German high-speed motor, torpedo boats, and gunboats to beat us up. In the night, in the middle of the night, they ran head-on into a British similar force, and they stopped to slug it out. And while they were slugging it out, we slid by and got into Marseille.
Oh my gosh.
You know,
wow.
That's the luck of the draw.
Yeah.
That you just wonder if God ordained it.
Yeah.
See, we had no escort.
No.
No surface escort.
No,
no air escort at all.
Yeah.
The war had got so far along that they couldn't protect everybody.
Yeah.
So anyway, we landed at Marseille, and we got on. We went inland a bit with the tanks, and then we got on these tank transporters, which were trailers. They'd drop a little tailgate, and you drove your tank up on it,
yeah.
And they chained everything down on this enormous big truck, pulled you along. So eventually, we stopped. We went through Lyon, I remember, on up. Eventually, we got into Belgium, and we were in Roulers, or Roussalara, if it's either Dutch or French. Mm-hmm. And the word came over the wireless set that's in the book there, halt where you are. So we halted where we were. And we were right there for 10 days. Everybody was sent on leave. I went over to England to see my brother, who was in the Air Force.
Which brother?
Warren.
Yeah.
But a lot of the boys wanted to go to Paris. I said, by God, I'm not going to go there. These guys wouldn't fight to defend their own country.
Yeah, exactly.
And here we were, losing men killed
to
give them their country back again.
Yeah.
But they were just sitting there in Paris and just waiting, you know, to...
Yeah.
Get every dollar they could. So I thought, well, if I survive this war, I'm going to need what money I've got. If I don't survive, Bernice is going to need it. But I'm not taking it to Paris.
Good for you.
So I went to England instead to see Warren.
Yeah.
Anyway, funny, you know, when Warren was flying over Germany night after night, and I was running around England playing games with the tanks, he said, when are the hell are you guys going to come and do some fighting to win this war? I said, Bub, you mark my words. When the first man goes ashore with the Lee Enfield rifle with a bayonet on the end of it, the war will be over in a year. Well, he just laughed. I was wrong. It was over in 11 months.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You can win a battle, but to win a war, you've got to get on the ground.
Uh-huh.
And you've got to stay there.
Yeah.
And more than that, you have to have the support of the population.
Yes.
But anyway, we went from, after the leave, we went from Roulers into Holland, and set up shop in Nijmegen.
Mm-hmm.
Nijmegen is a great big bridge there. You remember the bridge too far?
Yeah.
Well, the bridge that was too far was the one at Arnhem. See, the Rhine comes down to Emmerich and Cleve, and then it forks.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the Niederrhein, the Northern Rhine,
mm-hmm.
and the bottom is called the Wall, W-A-A-L. And the land in between, which goes right up to the coast, we used to call it Nijmegen Island, because it wasn't an island.
Mm-hmm.
You had to go over water to get to it.
Right.
It wasn't like a clump offshore somewhere. So We were told, the eight desires were told to go out on Nanagan Island and set up a defensive position at a certain map reference. So we did. And they said, we're going to leave a British light AK-AK regiment with you. Now, this British outfit, they were light trucks with a flatbed tractor and a 40-millimeter anti-aircraft gun mounted on the back of it. Mm-hmm. And they had, oh, God, I guess 40, 50 of these. So they were with us in case there was an air attack or whatever. Years later, I found out, and a Dutchman found out for me, we were there to guard the left flank of the Canadian Army as it crossed the Rhine. Now, nobody told us that. Nobody, we never knew anything about it. There's my, the husband of my maid of all work.
Oh, okay.
I guess he's going to rake some leaves. Anyway, he found that out. He got it through the access to information. And he actually showed me a copy of the order.
Really?
That the 8th Hussars will provide flank cover for the Canadian Army.
Yeah.
But they would never tell you this.
Yeah.
They were afraid the word would get out.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, we didn't know it, but there were about 200,000 Germans in Western Holland, Amsterdam and Rotterdam and all that area. And then there was a coast road that went along the coast and crossed over the Ems estuary and into Emden, and then down the German shore into the Ruhr Valley. And they thought, now those bastards can pull out of Holland any time and trot down that road, so we better cut it off. So again, all they told us was that we were to attack from Arnhem through to the coast, which was about 40 miles, and cut the coast highway. I didn't know it, they never told us, but they planned to have this over with in 4 days. In 3 days and a breakfast, my B squadron was astride the road at a place called Putten, out on the coast. I lost 3 tanks breaking out at Arnhem. I had 3 men killed. After that, we never stopped. When we got shot at, we'd fire a couple of rounds and just duck into bushes or go down behind a hill or somewhere and keep going. And the first night, I was about 8 miles right deep into the German lines, and I figured I was going to lose the whole thing. Because all they had to do was come in at night with the bazookas and boom, boom, boom. Every time they pulled a trigger, they could knock a tank out. But we could hear them running through the brush, and we got away with it. Next morning, God, we got a shot at a train. But before we could get the range, the train went around a curve and and we lost it. But that's how far back we were.
Yeah.
We're shooting trains.
Wow.
Well, anyway, by the way, I see a girl on giving the weather, I think, on TV, and her name is Barneveld. Well, there's a place in Holland called Barneveld, and that's where I was on the second day. Mm-hmm. And the Cape Breton Islanders had caught up with us, and I got this panic call to stop where I was, load the Cape Breton Highlanders on the back of the tanks, and head for a place called Otterloo. What had happened was we were going from Arnhem through to the coast. Appledore was up here. The 1st Division was coming down this way. And they were driving the Germans ahead of them. And at Otterloo, the 1st Division had occupied Otterloo, and they'd set up this great big prisoner of war camp, big barbed wire enclosure. So in the middle of the night, this Canadian Lance Corporal comes down the highway with a great big flock of Germans behind him. And of course, they all wear greatcoats, great to the ankles. And they just sort of shuffle along. So anyway, when they hit the first outpost, he challenged them. And this Lance Corporal said, "Never mind the effing password. Where can I get rid of these willies? Where's the PW cage?" Well, it turned out the Lance Corporal was a German in a Canadian uniform.
Shoot!
So the sentry said, "Well, you go down there and you'll see the cage." They got down there. All these guys opened their overcoats. They had machine guns and bazookas and everything, rifles underneath the coat. They opened they overpowered the guards at the cage, opened the cage door, released all these Germans in the cage. They were running loose all through Appledore, Otterloo. The brigadier jumped into his armored command vehicle and locked the door and got on the horn, and that's when he called me to get up there with infantry to beat these fellows off. Now, he had the brigadier, or the general rather, had under command an armored reconnaissance regiment, the glorified Governor General's Horse Guards. Very superior young chaps, and much better educated and cleaner and prouder than anybody else, and we hated their guts. So here he had this 77 tanks in this outfit, 77 tanks. But the officers, of course, wouldn't sleep with the men. The tanks were somewhere, and the riffraff looking after the tanks. The officers were all in a great big mansion, living and sleeping in quarters that befitted their standing in the army. Well, the Germans laid siege to this house, and these guys couldn't get back to their tanks. So the whole regiment was paralyzed, and the general was furious. So as we got near Otterloo, God, I could see tanks coming through the brush with the aerials, whipping overhead. So I shook the regiment out in battle formation, and we were ready. And when they broke out of the brush, they were the Governor General's Horse Guards. At last, had been able to get to their tanks. So anyway, I reported to the general, and he said, "Well, I guess we don't need you now." But he said, "Ellis, I want you to leave with me one troop. That's four tanks that he could depend on." That he could depend on. He disregarded these 77 glorified parade soldiers, and he wanted to be sure, he wanted to be safe, So we got a troop of four tanks from Tim Ellis, which I had left. Well, then we had to get the hell back to the main effort through to the coast. So here we were away to Helen Glan and the other part of the country. So I looked at the map.
Now I'm just checking my tape.
Yep.
Yep.
Looked at my map and I laid out a route on highways and side roads and open country right through to where I knew the point was. So there we were, barreling along these flat roads in Holland, pedal to the metal, 30 miles an hour, which was as fast as they'd go. And I can still remember the British instructor at the tactical school at Brasenose College in Oxford, where I learned all the dirty tricks and smart tricks of tack warfare. I can still hear him saying, whatever you do, never go motoring into battle. And here we were, line ahead, 20 tanks just going in a cloud of dust. Every now and then, he had a bunch of trees that have a gun in it. He'd take a shot at us, and I'd call the last troop and say, give them four or five rounds, but don't stop. And we got back to the point, and they had put a squadron, which was the reserve squadron, coming up from Arnhem to the coast. We started off C squadron and B squadron. C squadron got tangled up in ambushes and defiles and whatnot. So B was the point. The point of the point of the point, right at the front. So what they should have done when Hoffmeister called for help, they should have sent A squadron.
Yeah.
And they didn't. And this was the night of the third day. And our colonel, who should never ever have been allowed to command a regiment, kept pushing the A squadron ahead down the main street entrance in the Putten. And the Germans were in the ditches and in between houses, and every time a tank came along, they'd fire one of these bazookas. You know what a bazooka is?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same size shell that the battleship fired,
right,
only a man fires it off his shoulder.
Right.
And it'll just blow a tank to pieces. They'd be just lying in the ditch and the tank, poof! No one comes along, poof! And he kept ordering the, you know, keep going, keep going. And one awful bit of disgrace that has never been disclosed, I don't think, was one of the tanks got hit by the bazooka and the crew just bailed out. Well, the tank must have been in neutral gears because it was still there, vacant, the engine running. A German jumped in, he drove it away. And this was one of our tanks that had the 17-pounder gun, which was, it could go through anything. It had a barrel from here to there and a big muzzle brake on the end of it. And, God, the next day the word came out, the Germans are one of our tanks, one of our best ones. And eventually it was discovered in the middle of the town of Putten, burned.
Oh, okay.
And I know what had happened. They had stalled the engine making a turn and couldn't get it going again.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
These tanks had air-cooled aircraft engines in them, round radial engines, nine cylinders. And the engine was meant to run at a constant speed up in the air, so that all their power was at the top revolutions, the top two-thirds to three-quarters of maximum revs. So all your driver did most of the time was look at the needle on the tachometer. At 2400, the governor had cut the engine out altogether so the engine wouldn't tear itself apart. And when the needle got back close to 1500, he had to drop down a gear. Below 1500, the boys used to say they didn't have enough power to pull the skin off a custard. So, before you made a turn, you knew as soon as you put the drag on the inside track, that needle was going to really go right down. So you shifted down a gear before you made the turn. Well, that's what happened to the tank in the city. He made a turn, and the needle just went down and stalled the engine. Anyway, that was that. So we... We went into Putin, and you know, when you had people killed through stupidity, it just tore your guts out.
Yes.
When I saw the street start filling up with people, I pulled B Squadron out. We went way to the outskirts, and I found a little lane that had a few little cottages. And I pulled the whole squadron in there. And I left the downtown sections for the celebration. A Squadron went right into town.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hello. Hi there.
Hi. Donna.
Yeah.
Judy Carson.
Hi, Judy. I'm Donna James.
Hi.
Glad to meet you.
Shouldn't be shaking hands, I guess, but.
Oh, well, okay. I don't have the flu.
No, so nor do I. I don't think.
Okay.
This gutter here.
Mm-hmm.
All he does is par that guy.
Okay.
So the people were screaming and yelling and crying and hugging and kissing and everything. Three girls started to crawl up on the front of one of A Squadron's tanks. And I'll never forget the guy's name. His name was Ashton. And he had the flaps open on the
turret.
Well, it's just a door, just two doors that open.
Oh, okay.
And they started to crawl up on the tank, and I know what happened. He got up out of his seat to give them a hug or take their flowers. His knee hit the trigger on the machine gun.
Oh, dear.
Which he had not taken the belt out of. And the gun started to fire. One woman was killed right away.
Oh, my gosh.
The second one wounded, but survived. And the third one escaped. I think that's the way it went.
Oh, my dear.
You know, that guy, look. Oh, God, he came from Spring Hill, I remember.
Yeah.
But he was one of these slow-moving, gum-chewing fellas, you know. You'd ask him a question, and it'd take him 5 minutes to get the answer. But that's the sort of stupidity.
Yeah.
That used to just make me livid.
Yeah. Yeah.
That they would do a thing like that. And by the way, another time I lost my cool When we were out on this Nijmegen Island, during the crossing of the Canadian Army, I had 205-millimeter guns, which is bigger than the field artillery guns in the Canadian Army. And they were beautiful. Normally a shell has a copper driving band on it. And as it goes out through the rifling cuts into the band and makes it spin. Well, sometimes the shell would get a wobble. You'd hear them going overhead, loose driving band. The 105s had a driving band, and ahead of it, they had a solid steel band and another one behind it, which exactly fitted the rifling. And when that thing went out, it was just like a sniper's rifle. So what we used to do, we had enough instrumentation in the tank that we knew where the tank was on the map. In fact, we'd drive there to a crossroad or a big house, get right in beside the house. Well, you were there beside the house. You were there beside the house on the map. Then you would draw a line to where you wanted to shoot at. And then you'd take your you know, the half moon that you use.
All right, yes.
What is the name of it?
Not a protractor. Not a compass.
No.
Oh, what a thing. I know what you mean, yeah.
Anyway, they could measure. Oh, yeah. You would make a zero line to a fixed thing, a church steeple or a bridge or something that was on the map. That was your zero line. Well, then if you wanted to shoot at something else, all you had to do was measure off protractor.
Protractor, very good.
On your protractor,
yeah.
So many degrees switch to your target. Then you had to transpose from degrees to mils. Now, a mil is an angle which at 1,000 yards is a yard across the end.
Right.
And there's a thing on the turret floor, 6,400 mils. And you could rotate the turret and watch the arrow spin. And when you got to the number of mils you wanted, those two guns were right on that target. And all you had to do was pick up your mic and say, fire tank, fire target number three, five rounds gunfire. And bango. So anyway, we had the two 105s lined up on the zero line. And this crazy Bob Ross, who was in command of the operation, the ACAC people in my tanks, he wanted to shoot at something. And he wanted to go back to the guns. Well, I said, if you're bound to shoot something, I can fire the guns from here. You can fire them from here in the Jeep. Well, I said, we got a wireless set in the Jeep, and all I got to do is call them up and give them the coordinates, and they'll switch the gun on it and fire. You can do that? I don't think so. I said, damn well, sure I can do it. I've done it many times. No, I want to go back and see the guns. We went back to see the guns. One of them was right on the zero line. The other was off somewhere. And it turned out it was a hot day, and the driver decided he'd drive his tank under the shade of a big leafy tree. took the tank right off the center line.
Really? Yeah.
Well, look, if I'd ordered the gun to fire, they would have started for where they were.
Oh my God.
And put the gun onto divisional headquarters or something.
Yeah.
And fired. Strangely enough, this crazy character, this, his name was Bob Ross, I traveled with him a lot, He never knew where the hell he was. I was his sort of navigator.
Yeah.
He was a real cowboy.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to have to move you ahead because we're going to get into your lunchtime. So when did you finish overseas?
Well, one day after we'd had a real bad tangle on the ancestry at a place called Delft's Isle, suddenly the war was over.
Just like that. Yeah.
I had promised myself when the war ended I would have a Leica camera, I would have a pair of Zeiss binoculars, I would have a Luger pistol. And we used to see the prisoners go by with this stuff and we'd wave them back. And our reconnaissance troop would strip them
mm-hmm.
clean. They'd even take their watches. Some of the guys had watches on their shoulders. And there I was. The war was over. And I didn't have any of this stuff.
Oh, no, you didn't.
And the police were everywhere. They were looking for everything.
Yeah.
So that was it. Well, all through the war, I had this terrible skin condition, psoriasis.
Oh, yes.
And I knew if I went to hospital to get it cleared up, they'd pick up my blind eye and I'd be gone. Well, there's nothing disturbs your men like having a new officer pitchforked mm-hmm. into, parachuted in, that they don't know anything about. They don't know what he's going to do, how he's going to act, whether he's a good guy or a sinker or whatever. So that's why I hung tough right till the end of the war. And when the end of the war came, everybody had enough points
mm-hmm.
to get home.
Mm-hmm.
If you were married, you had so many points. If you were overseas, you had so many points. If you'd been wounded once, you had so many points. Twice, you had three times, so many more points. So everything was points. So I went to the doctor and stripped off and I said, "Doc, what can you do about this damn psoriasis?" He just took two steps back. He said, "Tim, that's the worst case of psoriasis I have ever seen." Now he said, "Whatever is giving you this is over here. So we're going to have to get you home." I said, "Say no more." Oh, yeah, they want me to, I had enough points to come home. That was it, I started to say. And when I mentioned, they said, "Well, you're not going anywhere." "I, what do you mean I'm not going anywhere? I got the points." "No," they said, "everybody from the rank of major up is frozen because there are all kinds of jobs that we're going to need, the military working with the civilian population to get things back to normal, and you're frozen." I thought, "By Jesus, I'm not frozen." So I went to the doctor and showed him my psoriasis. "Tim, we've got to get you to hospital." I'd say, "No more." I never did get back.
You didn't, yeah.
No. There's a picture in there of me coming home on a hospital ship. I was almost ashamed to be on it. I wasn't wounded or anything.
No.
But I get a pension for it.
Yes, you did.
And I still have it.
You do?
I still have it.
Good for you.
I still have it.
But what was your rank? What was your final rank?
Major.
Major, okay.
Yeah, there it is. It tells
Major.
You on the
book. Okay. And
I am now an honorary colonel.
Okay, that's
I tell
what I
people
thought.
I was an honest combat major.
Right, yeah.
But somebody in Ottawa thought I should be an honorary colonel of the regiment.
And rightly so.
So for 3 years, I was wearing three stripes.
Okay.
And they were parading me around like a stud horse at a country fair. with all my medals on. I drank more booze on that.
I bet.
On that colonel.
Yeah.
But you have it for life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
You have it for life.
Now, were both your other brothers, did they both serve overseas? I know Warren did.
Well, yeah. My brother, Ben, was in the Navy. He was on a Corvette. So we were all active. You know.
But you were all very lucky. You all got home.
All made it home.
Isn't that amazing?
Ben was lucky because after he got transferred from one Corvette to another, that Corvette was sunk.
Really?
And wow. Then the one he was on now, he got moved off that, and that one was sunk.
Oh my gosh. Isn't that something?
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you came back to Rothsay,
yeah.
Basically, and you've lived here ever since?
Well, you see, I was in the banking business.
Right, so.
I've been a banker for 6 years when the war started. And a lot of these people, you know, they thought I was an old man. Because, you know, I've been working.
Yes, yeah.
Some of them were, you know, working in sawmills or garage body shops or digging ditches or whatever. And there were kids who were 15 years old and said they were 18.
Yes.
And the army took them. And the mother didn't say anything because the mother got a check. Separation.
Yeah.
If a mother had three husky boys and they all joined the army, she got money from the three every month.
Right.
And these were families that never saw money.
Yeah.
Never saw money before.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, I remember, you know, you see these people that have psycho trouble. They can't adjust to civilian life.
Yeah.
Well, I had a dose of that.
Did you?
Suddenly I found myself back in Canada. God, I gotta go and buy my own clothes. I gotta find a doctor. I gotta find a dentist. I gotta find a place to live. I gotta buy my own car. I had enough money to buy a new Ford, and I went to the dealer to buy it. He didn't have any time for me at all. Well, when he got to trade, I said, trade? Why would I have any to trade, for God's sake? I've been out hunting Germans for 4 years. Well, you got to have something to trade. I have never bought a Ford car.
Good for you.
Since. I have never bought a Ford car.
I don't blame you.
Just for that reason.
Isn't that stupid?
Alone.
Yeah, yeah. That was stupid.
To hear this guy, they picked him up off a farm or somewhere, and he put him in a three-piece suit, and he was a car salesman.
Yeah, yeah.
Jeez,
So, but were you transferred around with the bank? Or
okay. Yeah. So I thought, and the bank had changed a lot. I had girls who would walk out at 5 o'clock, and their day's work wouldn't be finished.
Yeah.
Nothing balanced up or anything.
Yeah.
And they'd say, well, that's it. Jeez, I couldn't believe it. I'd tell them to do something while we're not doing that, Mr. Ellis. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody ever told me they wouldn't do something that I had told them to do. So anyway, I thought I'd better go back to where I left. So I went back to Hampton, and I was there for about a year and a half, and they moved me into Charlotte Street, and I got a house to live in out on Pugsley Avenue in the what's the settlement in back of Fort Howe. Anyway, I was in Charlotte Street for a little over 2 years. Then I got sent down to St. Andrews as a count. That was my first appointment.
Okay.
Before that, I was just a clerk somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
There 4 years, and then they made me a manager at Black's Harbor. I had a staff of three.
Wow.
Two. And that was the hardest branch I had till the day I retired.
Really?
God, I used to have letters of credit coming in by registered mail, written in Spanish, written in French. I had accounts where you never took the money out of U.S. funds, it had to stay in U.S. funds. I had money coming in from South America and South Africa where it was paid in Stirling, and Stirling had to be in London. I had special accounts in London. I had accounts in Black's Harbor. They were not Canadian dollars and American dollars.
Yeah.
The government had foreign exchange control, and there were all these regulations you had to abide by. And all I had was a teller and the girl who typed and looked after the books.
And that was it. Wow.
And that was that. Look, I was there 2 years, and it was like escaping a death sentence when I left. And they sent me to Bridgetown, Nova Scotia, a lovely place. I was there 2 years. Then they sent me to Sackville, which was my wife's hometown. I was there 5 years.
Oh, okay.
From Sackville, I went to Pictou. That was the longest I was anywhere. I was there 8 years. And then they sent me, I had trouble in Pictou. Things didn't work out. And they sent me to Siberia, which was Glace Bay. And I was there 6 years until I retired.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. Oh, that's quite a career. And you came back.
I've had quite a life. In the meantime, I get into horses, and I've had some lovely horses. I had one here for a while, a great big American saddlebred, the big, with the ears, you know, and the tail up, and the front feet, you know, like that. And the little girls, you know, they just, his name was Harry, and they just loved him.
I bet.
Because he was so showy.
Yeah.
You'd see a little 9-year-old tadpole sitting up on his back with her nose in the air, and you'd think that just those magic hands were all that was controlling this wild animal, and Harry was just taking for a ride around the bridge and over the jumps and the tail flipping,
really?
You know,
wow.
And they'd come up with a ribbon.
Yeah.
And they, you'd see them walk up and they'd kiss Harry on the nose.
Oh, nice.
I used to love. But one day one of the kids took Harry over to PEI for jumping, and somewhere or other he put his leg down a hole in the ground twisted his hip, and after that he was never any good. We had to put him down.
Aww.
When we put him down, all the little girls cried.
I bet.
So I wrote a poem about Harry.
Did you?
And posted it in the tack room.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice, yeah.
But I was up the other, this is, I'm talking now 15, 20 years ago.
Okay.
I was up the other day, I had a picture of four French horses jumping over a stile in France down at the camp, and my wife said, look, that's not a very seashore type picture to have. Why don't you take it down? So I took it down and I gave it to them. And the girl said, oh, I know you. You're the one that used to own Harry.
Ah, yeah.
She's got a horse over here.
Oh,
I don't know who she is.
Yeah.
Well, look, I don't want to keep you now.
No. Look, it's been very interesting. I don't know how much I'll be able to use to put in this section, but it's very interesting.
But anyway, you can take that book along.
Oh, I'd appreciate that.
In fact, you can have it.
Yeah. I can return it, though, if you want. I can return it.
Well, I had 25 printed.
Okay.
If you want to keep it, you can have it.
Yeah, we'll see. No, so you've had a long history in Rothsay, though, for sure.
Well, I've had quite a life. I haven't missed much.
No, for sure.
Yeah. The only thing I have never done, I've never been up in a helicopter. And just the sight of that single shaft and all that machinery going around, I can't get it through my head that this is safe.
Yeah.
And occasionally something goes wrong. Because that rotor head is full of cams and levers and springs and counterweights.
Yeah.
And all it takes is one little thing to go wrong.
Yeah.